So last week we left off with dealing with a miscellaneous commandments that are involved under the heading of dealing with your fellow man. We dealt with things of the nature of what do you do if you're borrowing something from somebody and it breaks, or what happens if you find your neighbor's animal on the road, or what do we do if a thief is caught? What's the cost that should be incurred there, a whole variety of different things that all would fit under kind of roughly the category of loving your neighbor as yourself. So how do I deal with my fellow man in a way that is fair and equitable and kind and righteous? And so chapter 23, we kind of ran out of time, and chapter 23 continues that theme for a little bit, and then moves into some other things in terms of national feasts and things of that nature. So to begin with, we'll deal with the first nine verses of chapter 23 and some of the things that God wanted them to deal with there. And you might take this whole section and say you could put it under the idea of doing what is fair and just, regardless of the circumstances. So the first is, you shall not bear false report, and do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. So if somebody else is giving a false report, that is, they're a false witness, like they did when Jesus was crucified, right? People got up and gave a false witness, said, don't join your hand with somebody else to be a malicious witness, to do harm to another person. And then it says, you shall not follow the masses in doing evil. So there's a biblical way of putting, don't fall for peer pressure, right? Don't do what everybody else is doing. And it emphasizes, you shall not follow the masses in doing evil, emphasizes the fact that just because everybody else is doing it doesn't mean it's right. And so that's a concept that goes all the way back to the old law. And then he says, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. So if everybody is saying this is the way we want it, then it says you don't join with them to twist or pervert justice. To pervert really means to warp it, to make it crooked. Don't do that. And then it says, really one of those kind of fascinating little tidbits in the Old Testament, in these Old Testament Jewish laws, he says, nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute. Now, every time I read that, it hits me at how surprising that is. Because if it were me and I were to write this, I would have written, nor shall you be partial to a rich man in his dispute. See, that would have been the first thing that hopped into my mind is, okay, why would you be partial to somebody who's rich? He could give you something. He can do you a favor. Now, to be fair, verse 8 will deal with that. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. So, you shouldn't pervert justice or be partial to a rich man either. But that's not what this verse is dealing with, where you deal with somebody who there's something in it for you. Right, that's why you would do it for a rich man. Is there something in it for you? Or you might be afraid they have the sort of power that would allow them to get back at you and cause you trouble later on. But a poor man, why on earth would you be partial to a poor man in his dispute? You're a jury member on a trial, and there's a rich man, and there's a poor man. Why would you be partial to the poor man? You felt sorry for him. In fact, they ran into this. Burlington Northern, the train company, ran into this for quite a few years, where people were being hit by trains, and they were taking them to court. The families were taking them to court and suing the train company. And in almost every case, the train company hadn't done anything wrong. Because after all, as a general rule, trains are hard to get hit by, right? They don't swerve. It's not like, oh, it just came out of nowhere for the most part. They've got train crossings. They've got lots of different things for warning systems and whatnot. They have the horns and everything. We're given rules of the road that you don't put yourself on the track, right? If there's a backup, like over there by, was it Lewis and Blueberry, you get a backup on Highway 2, you leave a gap where it is. That's part of the rules of driving. And yet people do get hit by trains. And so a family would take Burlington Northern to court, and they had a whole slew of these that happened for a while. And I don't know, maybe it still happens, I don't know. But they'd take them to court, and the family would come in, and they would lay out their case, and their whole case was, our loved one's dead, and we're just heartbroken. And so they'd get on the stand, and they'd sob, and they'd cry, and they'd talk about how their life has changed since that their loved one had died. And all of that's true. And then the train company would get up and they would defend their case. And their case was really not emotional. It was pretty analytical. Well, the train crossings were working. The conductor did what was customary, and he'd signaled his horn as he came through town. There was ample time. Everything was operational. And there was a car on the tracks. And we can't stop that fast, no matter how quickly we hit the brakes. So we hit the car, and the person died. Well, you see an emotional, crying family, and then you see a large, multi-billion dollar company, and guess what happened in a lot of the lawsuits? The money went to the family, not because they had a case, but because they were really emotional, and everybody thought, well, what's a little bit of money from a large corporation? But is that what's just? That's my question. So there becomes the problem, right? Now, if there was something done wrong, I don't care whether it's Burlington Northern, a big multi-million dollar company, or it's Pete on the street, it doesn't matter. Either way, wrong is wrong. But the problem is that we, as people, from a sincere place, see a poor man and we say, oh, but look at how sad he is. Or look at how much he has to lose. Or look at how hard life has been on him. But when it comes to justice, does any of that matter? It doesn't matter one whit. It doesn't matter what the backstory is. It's right or it's wrong. And so they're being told, don't show partiality towards a poor man. And then as I mentioned down in verse 8, it will say the same thing about one, don't take a bribe, which is somebody, really, that's somebody who has the money to bribe you and circumstance. And it says, a bribe will blind the clear-sighted and subvert the cause of the just. So then, along those same lines, in verse 4, he'll say, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you should surely return it to him. Now, why does he mention your enemy's donkey? Why not just say, if you see a donkey or an ox wandering away, return it to him? Why say enemy? It covers them all. That's right. If you would do it for your enemy, you'd do it for your friend, right? But if I said, if you see your friend's donkey wandering, that could leave out your enemy, couldn't it? He said, well, yeah, I see the donkey. I don't like that guy. He can find it himself. Let him come out here and drag it out. So it covers everybody in that. It's about not being partial. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You should surely release it with him. So in other words, we're just saying, look, you don't let the other people in the circumstance decide whether you're going to do what's right or wrong. That should have no effect on it whatsoever. And then verse 9, along those same ideas, he says, you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. So this, too, is the same idea, right? Don't oppress a stranger. Why say don't oppress a stranger versus don't oppress anybody? You know, it could just say, you shall not oppress. Wouldn't that match what God's idea is on it? Don't oppress. But we mention a stranger because why? It's more vulnerable. They're somebody you are more likely to do it to. If you wouldn't oppress a stranger, it's going to cover everybody else as well. And it also mentions there, you know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt, which emphasizes another ideal that God wants them to get to. Don't just do the right thing by the stranger, but when he says, you know the feelings of a stranger, what do we call it when you think about other people's feelings? You look at them, you see what they're going through, and you feel something for them. What do we call that? We call it compassion or empathy. That's right. We call it that feeling of extending beyond yourself into the circumstance, putting yourself in the shoes of another person is called compassion. And that's what God wants them to have. So we're going beyond just doing what's right, but we want you to begin to feel for that person. And so do the right thing. Don't show partiality, but do what is fair. So then you go down to verse 10, and we're going to begin to deal with some Sabbath-type laws. Now, the Sabbath really just means rest. And the most famous of all of the rests for Jews was what? When you think of keep the Sabbath, what is the Sabbath when we typically say that? It's a day of rest, and what day? It's Saturday. That's right. So when we talk about keep the Sabbath, we in general mean the Saturday rest, the weekly rest. But as you read through the old law, there were other Sabbath days as well that some of them happened instead of weekly, they'd happen annually. And in the case here, starting in verse 10, there was a rest that you were supposed to do for the land even. He says, you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield, but on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. So there was a Sabbath for the land. So you'd plant for 6 years and then you would take a year off. Now today, with modern farming, we understand why they should do that. And what's the reason, the scientific reason that you would want to do that? Right. It gives the soil a chance to rest and get new nutrients in it and things like that. And, you know, Steve, I imagine growing up that you'd leave the land fallow for a while, right? Or what would you do? Okay, so you'd rotate them, and then the other thing that we now do in modern farming that to re-energize the soil that they didn't do back then was what? We have modern fertilization techniques. So, yeah, I knew you might say that, so I had to get ready for it. We do things like crop rotation, we do fertilization, things like that. But that's because we know a lot of these scientific things. Let me ask you, did they know that? They didn't. They didn't know the things that we know in terms of chemistry and nutrients and whatnot. And so what God is doing with them is giving them some wisdom that will make them better farmers that they didn't know. And you'll see this throughout the Old Testament. Some of the things that you'll see in the Old Testament laws we go through are like medical things. Clean and unclean. What do you do when there's leprosy? And in general, the rules for something like leprosy is if somebody had leprosy, what were you to do with them? You'd isolate them. Yeah, we'd call it quarantining them today. But God doesn't call it quarantining there. He just tells them, put them outside the camp. Turns out that's a really smart medical idea. And then you compare many of the medical ideas of washing and things like that, hygiene, that you can find God giving the Jews, and you compare that to Egypt. Now, why would you want to compare what God's telling them to do as far as hygiene and whatnot compared to Egypt? Why would that be valuable to compare the two? What? Yeah, false gods, and that's right where they were, right? With those false gods and false teaching. So the culture they came out of, guess what they said if somebody was sick? Give you just some ideas. They'd say things like rub cow's dung on it. They would tell people to take and bleed themselves. Which, of course, in other cultures, have we seen that too, where people will bleed themselves to make themselves better? And yet here, what we find is that all the things that you look at in the Old Testament law regarding hygiene or horticulture, things like that, are things that scientifically we look back and we go, hey, you know what, that was actually a pretty good idea. In fact, a lot of the modern infection control rules that we have that came from World War I, World War II, that time frame, came from them saying that the Jewish surgeons, their patients did better and had less infection rate. Not because the Jewish surgeons knew about bacteria and things like that, but because the Jewish surgeons were following Jewish law. And Jewish law says, if you touch blood, what do? You go and wash your hands and you clean up. So many of these things that we find in here are God giving them wisdom that they would not have had otherwise. Now, when God gives them this rule regarding letting the land lay fallow, does he tell them it's a good horticulture practice? He didn't tell them why. He just says do it. But it turns out when you do what God says, it also has some benefits as well. Verse 12, now we get to the Sabbath rest that we're probably most familiar with. He says, 6 days you're to do your work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from labor so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave as well as your stranger may refresh themselves. So when you take a Sabbath, you can't take a Sabbath and still tell your slaves to go work. The Sabbath is everything shuts down. Later on, once they're in the land and they have the kingdom and Jerusalem has its walls and everything, Nehemiah, amongst some other rulers at different times, would say, on the Sabbath day, we just shut the city gates. No commerce, nothing. Just shut the whole thing down. It's a day of rest. And then he says, verse 13, now concerning everything which I said to you, be on your guard and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. So you obey what I say, and then if you start thinking about, well, but the other gods say this, or if we worship this god, it'll be this way. What does he say about that? Don't you even mention them. Don't even talk about them. I'm your only god. So he lays that out, and then the next thing we see is in verse 14 through 19, he's going to mention the three major national feasts of the Jewish kingdom. And those three feasts are the three feasts that they were to go and travel to wherever the tabernacle was, which would eventually be where? Where in the long run, where's the tabernacle going to end up? It's going to end up in Jerusalem, so it ends up becoming a pilgrimage to Jerusalem three times a year. And so he says, 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For 7 days you're to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you. Now the feast of unleavened bread is also known as the Passover feast. Now the Passover was a meal that was on one day, but the festival was actually 7 days. And so the Passover is one of those days, and then you had it was a whole week for the week of unleavened bread, which I think I mentioned not too long ago is one of the reasons we know that when Jesus took the Lord's Supper, it was unleavened bread, because it was during the feast of unleavened bread. So that kind of seals the deal, right? So that's one that they were to keep. And then he says, and that was to be in the month of Abib, and let's see if I can pull that. Nope, that's not what I wanted to do. There we go. Yeah, that's a pointer. So that's going to be... where is... This is... Okay, so the dates are wrong, but I'm realizing just now that the Nisan may be wrong there. But this is the time frame. So they had a lunar calendar. And so in the March-April time frame is when the Passover would be. So we run on a solar calendar. They run... Yes? Oh, that's right. And all the calendars I always look at, normally it says Nisan / Abib. Thank you. Yes. Okay. So the error is not with the chart. It was with somebody else. when you look at it, that's going to be in the March-April time frame, which also tells you when Jesus was crucified, which was at what time, what festival, right? The Passover feast. What time of year was Jesus crucified? March-April time frame. So, though Easter is not a biblical holiday, right? Easter is a Catholic holiday of celebration of the death and resurrection of Jesus. Are we supposed to do that annually? When do we do it? Every Sunday. We're to remember that every single Sunday, so weekly. So that's not a biblical holiday. When they put it in the April time frame, are they close to the mark? Yeah, they actually are kind of close to the mark. As much as I would make my life a lot easier if they weren't, because I could just say, they're not even close, like Christmas. They're not even close. But with Easter, they kind of got the dating right in the right time frame, because they can use that lunar calendar to come up with it, which also is, by the way, why April, the Easter kind of shifts a little bit. That's the first feast. And then you go down to verse 16. He says, also you shall observe the feast of the harvest of the first fruits of your labor from what you sow in the field. Also the feast of the ingathering at the end of the year. So the feast of the first fruits, that is Pentecost. So Pentecost is actually a Greek term. And it's like where we get Pentagon, right? It comes from 5, or in this case 50. Pentecost is 50 days after the Passover. So they just called it Pentecost. But it is the same feast as the feast of the harvest of the first fruits. And so it comes just 50 days after the feast of unleavened bread or Passover. Then the other one, which is the feast of the ingathering at the end of the year, it also had another name, which was the feast of booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles. So that one is the one over here at the end of the year, which happened in more the October-September time frame. So three times a year, the Jews were to come to where the tabernacle was, which would eventually be Jerusalem, for the Feast of the Passover, for the Feast of Pentecost, and for the Feast of Tabernacles. And so that's a law that was being laid down for them. And verse 17 says, three times a year, all your male shall appear before the Lord God. So that was required that not necessarily the whole family, but all of the men had to at least go, which of course meant most of the time, many people would bring their whole families. There were other feast days under the Jewish law, but these are the three main ones because they required a pilgrimage to do it. There's kind of the dating on that. Does anybody have any comments or questions there? Yes, sir.
So what's the ramifications for that? I guess it wasn't outlined in the old law. If they weren't able to make the feast, then they were required to go to?
Yeah, so there was a certain amount of allowance made for it. So with the Passover, at least, there was an occasion where people were unclean and they couldn't eat of the Passover. And so when that happened, they went to, I believe it was Moses, and went to Moses and said, what do we do? And Moses consulted God, and God said, okay, they can do it the same time the following month. So there was an allowance made in that case, at least for the Passover. Whether that would also fit the case for the other two feasts, I don't know, but that particular one was allowed. But you're talking about like dispersion stuff, aren't you?
I'm thinking like Jesus' family in particular, like some poor families making the trip from Nazareth to say Jerusalem. That's a big undertaking and pretty costly, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, it's a multiple day journey for sure, and I think part of the allowance, I guess, that was made there was that the whole family doesn't have to go. Right, so that would be part of it, but no, it was it was just required. It was simply required of them. It gets particularly difficult when you start realizing that as they sinned, because that's what sin does, is make a mess out of things, and they sinned, God kicks them out of the land, and so many of the Jews didn't even come back to the land after captivity. So then it's like, well, what then? So they ran into a lot of problems with that. As long as they were in the land, it was it was a long journey, like you said, Nazareth being closer to the north, northern edge, not all the way up at the top, but pretty close. It was a multiple days journey, but it was a doable. But when you start talking about people living in Rome and whatnot, it moved beyond that. But as long as they were still living in the land, it was doable. And the other thing we have to remember is it becomes a whole lot more doable if everybody else is doing it too, right? One of the reasons that it's hard for us as Christians to commit to Sunday worship is because a lot of society, you work retail or things like that, what do they want to do? Want to have you work on Sundays. But if you live in a culture where everybody took Sunday off, it'd be a whole lot easier. And that was what the culture was meant to be, is that everybody's doing it, so it was kind of understood, all commerce and everything shuts down. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're right. Jeroboam appealed to that. Exactly what you're talking about. Jeroboam, when the nation divided, appealed to that, the difficulty in the travel, and said, no, don't travel all the way down here. Just go to this golden calf I've made, because those have worked out really well for us. But yeah, that was his appeal. It was that particular thing. So yeah, it was a hardship. I mean, there's no doubt about it. In the same way that many other of God's commands were hardships. You think about even just taking the Sabbath off. If you're trying to compete in trade with the surrounding nations, are they taking the Sabbath off? No. So, you know, they're out there working and hustling, and you're going to take a standstill. That could play out. Any other comments or questions? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's a good example. The Ethiopian eunuch, certainly, that was quite the trek for him to go and do that. And many of the people who did make that sort of trek often would stay at least for both Passover and Pentecost. I mean, because it's like, you think about Passover, then 50 days later you're going to have Pentecost. Well, you might as well just hang tight if you're going to, you know, have such a massive journey. So, yeah, it was a hardship, no doubt about it. Okay, so then we move to verse 20, here we begin to deal with some of the things that they're to keep in mind as they enter the land. He says, "Behold, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him." So this angel is going to go ahead, and he's going to watch over you, and he's going to take care of you, but what do you need to do? You don't fool around. You obey him, right? And he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him. So what he says goes. Now, one of the things we're told in the New Testament, at least, is that Moses was a mediator for a law that was received through angels. So just like at the burning bush, it says that God spoke to Moses, but he spoke through who? Anybody remember? Who was at the burning bush? It said it was an angel. Yeah, it was an angel at the burning bush. So the old law was God was conveying these things through angels in many cases. And here he mentions this angel that would go before them to drive out the enemies of the land. And then verse 23 says, "For my angel will go before you and bring you to land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. You shall not worship their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their deeds, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars in pieces. But you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will remove sickness from your midst. And there shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come. And I'll make all your enemies turn their backs to you. I'll send hornets ahead of you so they'll drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and Hittites before you." So all of these things, he says, look, if you obey me, how much am I going to drive them out? Totally and completely. But now, there's an interesting thing that happens in the very next verse. "I will not drive them out before you in a single year. that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. So God says, I'll drive them all out, but it's not going to be like snapping your fingers. You're going to go and you're going to fight and you're going to take over the land, but you're not going to get it in one day. It's going to be a process. Now, if you trust that process, how much of the land are you going to get? All of it. If you don't trust the process, you're going to end up with problems. And this angel who's going to drive them out before you, he's not going to pardon you. He's not going to make your life easy because I've sent him. Well, when you look ahead to when they do actually take the land, a whole nother generation later, it does happen exactly that way. They don't get it all in one day. And in fact, as they're driving them out, there's little remnants left that they should have kept driving out. But what do they do instead? They leave them. We've got enough of the land. We've accepted, 80% possession, whatever it is. You know, we have control of it. There's just these little pockets and we'll let them be. Well, how's that going to work out? It's going to be awful for them. Because they're going to be a snare to them. And so, God told them the plan up front. That's what I want you to see. God told them the plan. I'm going to do it, but it's not going to happen fast. It'll be little by little. It won't happen in 1 year. So be patient, right? That's the message of that. Be patient. I've got a plan. It'll work, but you've got to be patient and trust me. And he'll even go so far as to tell them the boundaries. He says, I'll fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, from the wilderness to the river Euphrates. I'll deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you'll drive them out before you. So here's all the land. I'm going to give it to you, and you shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, because they will make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So God lays out this beautiful plan he has, but they must be patient for that plan to work out, and they must not compromise the plan. Now, Paul tells us these things were written for our example. We're not conquering a land like they were, but we can still learn the lessons. Trust God's plan and be patient, and don't compromise. Because if you do either of those things, you're going to have trouble. Anybody have any comments or questions there? Okay, so now at this point, he has laid out what we would call the basics of the covenant. This is what you're agreeing to. So Moses, to kind of back up in your mind, God has given this to Moses, and Moses has delivered this to the people. And now we're going to go from there to what do the people feel about this agreement? Because after all, that's what a covenant is. It's an agreement between two or more parties. And so God has said, okay, this is what I'll do for you. I'll do all of these things, but I expect these things of you in return. And so chapter 24 is going to deal with them agreeing to the covenant. So it's a voluntary arrangement. So he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him. Remember, we're there at Mount Sinai. And Moses came, and he recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken we will do. So Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. So here, you can think of this in a very similar way to where we do contracts today, right? You talk to somebody that you're going to make an arrangement with, right? Dan, you maybe you're going to take on a new building, and it typically starts with a conversation, right? This is what we'll do, and this is what it costs, and you talk it through, and everybody says, okay, we agree to those terms, and then what do? Do you just leave it at that, or is there something next stage? You got to write contracts, right? Because somebody might forget what we talked about, right? And so we're going to write it all down, and then we're going to sign that contract. And that's the process of making an agreement, a legally binding agreement. And that's what he's doing here. So Moses tells all the people, he recounts it, and the people say, we agree, we'll do it. So then Moses writes it down. And it says, then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood, and he put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And then he took the book of the covenant, and he read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient." So now, we've talked about it, but now it's written down, and he reads what he wrote down, and everybody says the same thing. And then Moses took the blood and he sprinkled it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Now, I want you in your mind's eye to envision what happened here, because it's actually a pretty big deal. And I'll show you why it's a big deal in a second. 12 tribes and their sacrifices for all 12 tribes. And they pour the blood out from the sacrifice. And half of it goes on an altar, and half of it goes into a bowl. And what do we do with the blood in the bowl? We sprinkle it on who? On the people. So now, the altar represents who? Who's an altar for? That's God, right? And then the blood goes, so the blood goes on the altar, that's God, right, representing him. And then the blood goes on the people. What we have here is a contract. And what did we just make that contract with? What was the signing of the contract? Blood. Turn over to Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9, down in verse 19. The Hebrew writer talks about this specific event. He says, "For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to law, he took the blood of the calves and the goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, 'This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you.' And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood." We haven't gotten to that event yet, but eventually when they build the tabernacle, they'll have to do the same thing. "And according to law, one may almost say, all things are cleansed with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness." Now, what we have under the old law was God setting it up. Okay, we're going to agree to a contract of which I protect you, I watch over you, I am your guardian, I'm your protector, I forgive your sins, I do all these things, and we sign it with blood. Now, he does that over and over again. As Hebrews 9 mentions, they'll do the same thing with the tabernacle. How do we make this tabernacle a special place where you can go and go before God and have your sins forgiven? We do it with blood. Why would he do that? What's the whole point of the Old Testament over and over again? Whenever God makes an agreement, he does it with blood. He's pointing to Jesus. That's right. Because the Old Testament is a shadow of greater things. It's not about the blood of the bulls and the calves. It's about the blood of Jesus that makes it so you and I can be sprinkled clean from our sins. So what Jesus did is Jesus was the signing of the contract. He's the one who made it possible so that you and I, under the new law, have an agreement between God and us as Christ's people that we will be forgiven. But it's also a contract, right? It's a covenant. And in a covenant, there's both blessings for you and expectations, isn't there? So just like the Jews, did they have blessings that God was offering in his contract with them? Many, many blessings. First and foremost, you go into the land and I'll take care of you. I'll drive them all out before you. No problem. In fact, I'll do it at just the right pace at just the right time that everything works out just fine. But don't you get caught up in idols. Don't you turn your back on me. Don't you show partiality. Don't you get caught up in the ways of idols. You do what I say. I'm going to be your one and only God, and my name is Jealous. So it's an agreement. There's both blessings and expectations. And so too, end of the new covenant, what should we expect? Blessings and expectations. So you see both, right? And which has greater blessings, the Old Testament or the New Testament? New Testament, right? Far greater blessings. So what should we expect in terms of expectations? Far greater expectations, right? More is expected of us than was expected of those Jews. More is expected of us because we've got a greater covenant that's come. We have better promises. And so here, as they're agreeing to their covenant, they're saying, yes, we'll do it. But did they really understand how serious they had to take that? We know they didn't, because did they follow through with that? Nope. It was a bigger deal than they expected. It cost more than they thought. They had to make choices that were harder than what they expected to do. And so, if that was the case with them, what should we expect to find sometimes in following Christ? It's going to take you places, yeah, that are harder than you thought would be. Greater promises too. Blessings and expectations. The blood of the covenant, which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. Then verse 9, he says, then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky itself. And yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they saw God, and they ate and drank. So all of these people, they go up there, and these rulers, the leaders, the 70 elders, Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, and they see God. Now, what do you know they didn't see? Well, there's spoiler alert. There's something they didn't see, because if they saw it, they'd die. What? Yeah, Matt's got it. The face. That's right. You didn't see his face. But they saw God and the glory of God. And I imagine it this way. If you're talking about how beautiful God is, even if you just saw his big toe, would that be more beautiful than anything else you'd ever seen? Right? Even the big toe of God is more beautiful than you can imagine. So they go up and they get to see this scene, and that should have made an impression on them. And then verse 12 says, the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction. Now, this is not those stone tablets, but I put this up here so you can get an idea of how small you can write on stone. Because most of us have a vision in our mind of carving into stone being large letters. And yet, this is a close-up of the Rosetta Stone. And I can tell you that even in this picture, because I've seen the British Museum did a roadshow, and I've seen one. They did an exact replica of the Rosetta Stone. I don't think actually they have the Rosetta Stone out for people most of the time because they're so concerned about it. But they have an exact replica that looks just identical out. And I can tell you, it's smaller than you think. It's even smaller than it looks up there. You could fit, you know, in that kind of a space, you could fit two or three lines width of writing on the Rosetta Stone. And so they can write really small. Now, I say all that because Moses is going to go up and he's going to come down with two stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I've written for their instruction. And we talked a little bit about this before. That's not just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, the Ten Commandments. This is the law. The whole thing is there. That beginning covenant that God has for them is all there. In other places it describes that it was the stones were written on the front and on the back. So you can fit a lot of text there. And so Moses is going to go up and he's going to get this law. Now, have they heard the law already? Yeah, it's written in a book. Why are we going to put it on stone? What's the value there? It's permanent, right? That's the idea. We even say it's etched in stone. That's a saying, right? It's etched in stone means we're not changing it. I don't know whether I could back it one way or the other, but some commentators do even assert that the reason there's two stone tablets is actually it's two copies because it's a contract. And then you have a contract, who gets a copy? Both parties. I don't know whether that's the case or not, but I kind of like the imagery. So you just take it for what it's worth. I'm not saying that's the case, but those two stone tablets, they're going to go where? Anybody know? Where are they going to go? They're going to go in the tabernacle, in the ark. So how often are those going to be looked at? They're not. They're really just not going to be looked at, right? But when the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies, he stands right in front of that ark. So the man who represents Israel stands right there in front of that ark, and God meets him right there in the mercy seat. And the mercy seat is just the lid of the ark. And what's in the ark? The contract. It's a really beautiful picture when you think about it. The high priest going in once a year to that tabernacle and going in so that God would forgive the nation. And he stands before the ark and God descends on the mercy seat. And right there, right in front of both parties, is this contract. And God's etched it in stone because that's what he says, is that God wrote it. And now Moses is going to break that, and that was a bad decision. But it gives you this idea of the permanence of it and how seriously God wanted them to take it, as well as how seriously he took it. So you have this picture here. So Moses is to go get those stone tablets. And then verse 13, Moses arose with Joshua his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. So the others are told not to approach. And Moses is going to go up, and he'll be up there 40 days and 40 nights, and that's where we'll stop class right now. Anybody have any comments or questions? I apologize for going a little bit over there. Okay, we'll pick up in chapter 25 next week.